Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Can your physical address and the things that surround it predict how satisfied you'll be with your life on any given day? Of course, everyone wants safe, functional housing. Many of us choose our homes based on how much we can get for what we can afford. But if we're looking to be happy, my guest today would urge us to think at least as much about where our homes are located and how they cause us to relate to the communities that lie just beyond our front doors. Journalist Charles Montgomery explains this in his new book, Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Charles, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks for having me.
So the genesis of this project is rather unique. You took a bicycle ride with the then mayor of Bogota, Colombia.
I did. I was traveling in South America. I was interested in cities, and I took a ride with this fellow. Enrique Peñalosa was his name, and this was actually after his mayoral term. And this guy claimed to have used his city as a laboratory for the science of happiness. He claimed to have used his three-year term to redesign the city to make people happier, specifically because he said, you know, we're not going to get as rich as the gringos for generations. So let's set a new goal. And that was his.
And it's interesting because it would seem as if most people would try to copy what was taking place in better developed parts of the world. And he had a really interesting way of sort of rethinking the things that mattered within a city.
He did. So first of all, you need to understand in a city like Bogota, only one in five families owned a car. And yet, in the developing world, and this is happening all over the world right now, cities are trying to copy American cities by building more freeways. It's seen as a high-status way to go. It's seen as the future. And he turned around and he looked at this city report that had been created by the Japanese International Development Agency, which said, oh, you need to pour $4, $5, $6 billion into an elevated freeway system for your city. And he thought, well, wait a minute, why would they say that? Well, one reason is Japan wants to sell more cars. And so instead, he devoted his city's budget to schools, daycares, parks, and how he got traffic moving, actually, not with freeways, but by giving the best and fastest road space to a rapid bus network. And it got everyone moving faster, even car drivers.
And what was the result for people and how they felt about life in Bogota?
Well, nobody was polling for happiness in Bogota at the time, but Gallup was actually polling for optimism. And remember, at the turn of the century, Bogota was one of the most miserable places to live on Earth. Terribly congested, polluted, dangerous, and people had felt really pessimistic about the future. By the end of his term, polls said that people were now optimistic about their own lives and the life of their city.
So the study of happiness and the study of urban design seem like two things that are very far apart. How did they begin? How did people start thinking about the value of considering these things together?
Well, I can only tell you about my journey. And it was coming away from Bogota and after spending time with this fellow who's quite an evangelist for his ideas. Mm-hmm. It's very inspiring. And yet, I'm a journalist. I left thinking, well, okay, you say you made your city happier, but where's the proof? Where's the science? Where's the evidence? And I think to start answering that question, can the machine be a city for happiness, you have to first decide what you mean by happiness, and then look to neuroscience, behavioral economics, psychology, to see how designs might change the way people feel in their everyday lives.
So what do you mean by happiness, Charles?
Well, my happiness is different than yours, I'm sure, but I'll try to sum up my opinion on happiness, and that is the best judge of a person's happiness is that person. So now that neuroscientists have popped people into magnetic imaging systems, they've found that when they just ask people how happy they are on a scale of 1 to 10, people's answers actually correspond pretty well with activity and pleasure centers of their brain. They also find that happier people have less stress hormones in their blood. And then the economists have taken this knowledge that, A, you can trust people when they say they're happy, and compared survey results around the world with societal data on suicides, on public health, on income. And so if I was to ask you how happy you are on a scale to 1 to 10, I think I should trust your answer.
Well, we know that correlation and causation are not the same thing, but they are often confused. So tell us about how researchers have tried to empirically measure the happiness potential provided by particular neighborhood designs.
Sure. Well, I have to say you're bang on the point about correlation and causation. My starting point was to look at studies that compared life satisfaction, which is another kind of way of measuring subjective happiness, and other factors. And what they found, and this was looking at Canadian cities, I'm calling from Vancouver, Canada, is that the higher the level of trust people expressed in their neighbors and strangers in any given city, the happier people in that city also claim to be. So to me, this is a very powerful piece of information, because in Canada, at least, Canada's richest, most high-status cities are actually not its happiest cities. The happier cities are smaller places where people trust their neighbors more.
So trust makes sense because we don't feel like we have to sort of walk around watching our backs. One surprising thing, though, is that we sort of associate being able to trust one's neighbors with, say, living in a very small town. And that's not necessarily borne out by the research.
Well, very small towns, I would actually say, are generally pretty good for interpersonal trust. And I should clarify that when we're talking about trust, trust is interesting, but it's kind of a proxy. It's a marker for something much bigger, which is strong, positive social relationships. So when you trust your neighbors, it may have more to do with how often you see them than how much they may lie, cheat, or steal. So one thing we know, looking at American cities, and this was very sad for me to discover, both in my research spending time with commuters and also looking at the data, is people living on the ex-urban edge in car-dependent communities, far from work, depending on their cars, are the least likely to trust their neighbors, the least likely to spend time with their neighbors, do favors for neighbors, and even have dinner with their own families. So what it suggests is that the super sprawling city is a very dangerous place for personal happiness.
Which is really ironic, because it seems that many people move away from the city as far as they can possibly get without, leaving being too far away from where they work. They do that hoping to be happy, right? They go to these places to give their families a nice home, to have a good experience, to maybe have a big yard.
Yes. Okay. You raise a couple of complicated, difficult subjects. Number one, I don't believe that Americans have much choice, have much freedom in their cities, because for the past 60, 70 years, Americans, and Canadians too, have been building cities that force people to depend on their cars. I mean, how many of your listeners have actually designed their own neighborhoods? Very few. I didn't get to design mine. Somebody might come back and say, well, hey, the city is a product of thousands or millions of independent actors choosing what's best for them. Well, it's actually not completely true, because the city is an artificial product. Americans, in particular, have invested heavily in subsidizing sprawl by pouring money, lots of money, into freeways and giving mortgage tax breaks, for example, and underinvesting in transit. And also, because of the zoning rules that were laid down many decades ago, many American cities, and I think Dallas is one of these, offer people less freedom to do what they want with the land they own. Most people in single-family neighborhoods, if you tried to open a barber shop in your garage, forget about it. Against the law.
And so that affects urban density as well, in many places where you can't necessarily have a garage apartment for rent.
That's right. That's right. It affects every facet of urban living. So, I drove to work and back with super commuters in Southern California. These people lived in California's Central Valley and commuted into the Bay Area, sometimes 4 hours a day round trip. And they would have loved to live closer to work. Why couldn't they? Because real estate prices were so expensive in the Bay Area. Why was that true? because of anti-development activists and pressures who wouldn't allow for more slightly dense neighborhoods near the city centers.
So, Charles, before so many of us had cars, virtually every dense urban area was a multi-use area, right? Because you could only walk so far to get a variety of services done, to get to your job. How did we get to the place where we really partitioned our cities into districts for different functions?
Well, some people like to blame the modernist idealists of the 1920s and 1930s. Some people like to blame a conspiracy of automobile manufacturers. Me, since I've spent so much time looking at the psychology of how we make decisions around risk and reward in cities, I think there's a little part of blame that lies in all of us. Humans, actually, we're not so good at choosing what makes us most happy in a complex modern society and in cities. So what am I talking about? Well, first of all, we all have a tendency to simplify complex problems. It's the most natural thing. Mythmakers have done it since the dawn of time. Well, we've also done it when building cities. So city planners have created city zoning plans that segregate the uses of land in our cities. So you put shopping over here, you put your business over there, workplaces over here, your park over there, and residences over here. What it means is that all of us are forced to drive between these places. And, you know, you talked about people moving to the suburbs in order to create a good, happy life, often for children. Here's where we can get it wrong again. Let me tell you what I mean. People sometimes move away from inner cities, or they have for decades, because of the fear of other people, say, the fear of being killed. Well, here's what we know, is that if you live in sprawl suburbia, you're much more likely to be killed by a stranger than if you live in the inner city. It just happens to be that that stranger might be driving a car. I was amazed to see that in Texas, not a day has gone by in the last 10 years where someone has not been killed in a motor vehicle accident in Texas.
So we worry too much about getting murdered and not enough about getting mowed down?
Perhaps that's true. I would extend our cognitive error to this. As you're probably aware, America is experiencing an epidemic of diseases of sedentary living. So if you move to some place where you're completely dependent on a car, and so are your children, it means your children are going to die sooner. Living in a sprawling city has the effect of 4 years of aging. And it also has a terribly traumatic effect on our relationships. One study showed that people who endure more than a 45-minute commute are 40% more likely to divorce.
And that could be because, what, they're missing family dinners and they're having to leave really early, that sort of thing?
Well, there is some added stress on the road. But I think it's primarily because you're not getting that crucial social time with your family.
My guest is journalist Charles Montgomery. His new book is called Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Charles Montgomery. His new book is called Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Charles, I have a daughter who plays soccer, and we live in the sort of urban core of Dallas, but many times for tournaments we have to drive far outside the city, and they have these massive, amazing multi-sport complexes that do not exist in my neighborhood. But in my neighborhood, there are parks that the kids can walk to on their own. Can you talk about the relative value of both of these things?
You've actually just pointed to a very powerful and concerning finding that public health researchers have found about urban design, which is that if kids can walk to a park in 5 or 10 minutes, they will, if their parents let them, of course. If they can't, they won't. And so what's happening now is, amazingly, American kids gain weight over the supposedly fun-filled summer months because many are stuck at home, because there's nothing accessible nearby. So I have a concern about these mega sports complexes that many communities are very proud of. You know, I have some in my own city, you know, 13 soccer or baseball fields all in one complex. I actually think investing in these is pretty bad for children's health if you're not also investing in micro-scale parks and communities. You know, looking at Atlanta, public health researchers found out that someone who lived in Midtown, which is kind of a mixed-use area, a bit like Uptown in Dallas, is likely to weigh 10 pounds less than someone who lives out in a cul-de-sac in the sprawl surrounding Atlanta. The city shapes our behavior. It shapes how we feel about each other. It shapes our bodies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mark in Argyle. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you so much. Enjoyed the program.
Thank you.
Fascinating topic. My question is addressing the general notion of the vicious cycle of the economics of modern city living and the general lack of economic diversity closer towards the core of the cities we get. A cursory view of any real estate website in North America shows that the cost of living in cities is simply too much for a huge number of people. And I would just be curious to hear what the author says about the bottom line economics of living in cities and how happiness is, in many ways, correlates with income.
Yeah, thanks for your call. What can you tell us about that, Charles?
Sure. This raises a couple of points. Yes, the cost of living in cities is becoming increasingly prohibitive, particularly as people see new value in living in central cities. The flight to central cities seems to have ended. People are moving back downtown, and real estate costs are going up. I was very concerned to see that HUD, your federal housing agency, is actually coming down hard on Dallas for not working harder to have more inclusive housing. It's crucial that there's housing for everybody in city centers, just as in any other neighborhood. But I want to raise another point, and this is where numbers can be deceiving. Sometimes when we buy houses, we think just of the cost of the house, when in fact we should be thinking of housing and the cost of transportation. You know, Americans like to blame greedy banks for the mortgage crisis a few years back. What happened before the mortgage crisis was gas prices spiked, and people who were living in outlying communities, and these are people I met throughout your country, suddenly were paying $800 a month just to get to work and back. And those are the people who lost their homes first.
We have all heard the adage that good fences make good neighbors, but you actually found a community where people got together and decided to tear down those fences and created something pretty amazing.
Yeah. You're talking about a little neighborhood in Davis, California. And I think this is one discovery I made that was very heartening in the book was that people just stopped waiting for governments to change their neighborhoods and cities and started to do it themselves. So these neighbors, first of all, realized that they were all having dinner in the same house. They liked each other, and so they thought that was a pretty cool idea. Why not spend more time together? They tore down their fences in the inside of the block. So all of a sudden, they owned their own land, but they just shared a common green in the middle of a lot. There was a garden over here, a playing field there. What it meant was that here in this world of where we have more and more single parents, that the kids in this neighborhood could run free like kids haven't done for decades because they were being watched over by other trusted parents in the neighborhood.
So they're spending time together, and they've essentially created a pocket park in their own neighborhood.
They essentially did, and they did it by sharing, by bringing down those barriers of mistrust and sharing resources with each other. In the end, what they did was they all invested in a slightly bigger house, a central house, and now these people share many of their meals together. And when I visited, I said, well, this sounds kind of socialist to me. And the guy laughed. He goes, no, not at all. We own our own land. But we all decide that we want to make our life easier by sharing some meals in the big house. People want to do it, pay a little extra, make life easier. You cook once a month instead of every night.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Tara in McKinney. Hi, Tara.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Welcome.
My question is, did any of your research indicate that Americans may be, especially middle-class aspiring Americans, may be just a little bit too superficial to give up their big, sprawling three-car garage and, three-bedroom, four-bath type of homes to sacrifice smaller properties that allow them to live in more walkable communities?
Well, what I did learn is, I don't want to pick on Americans. I fall into this trap, too. I was buying a house in my city in Vancouver, and we with a friend actually, because real estate here is quite expensive, and getting a big mortgage to lift it up and build our dream home. When I discovered what economists call the evolutionary happiness algorithm, and what this suggests is, we want more stuff, and we're going to keep wanting more stuff until we die, unless we check ourselves. So you get your mortgage, you build your big house, you fill it with stuff, and you tend to get used to that stuff after about 3 months. And then you find yourself wanting more. What the psychologists are telling us now is there's one kind of thing that you don't get used to, and that's experience, and especially experience with family, friends, and other people. So we can perhaps build smarter places if we start valuing our relationships and our experiences more than we value things. And that's starting to happen in cities around the world.
And the reason for that might be that, as you say, we come home to the same, let's say, dream house every day. We get accustomed to it. Sooner or later, a few years later, we look at something bigger and better. But every time we have an experience, it is somewhat different than the last one, as opposed to our house not really changing.
Yeah, you're nailing it. You're nailing it. And the lucky thing is we actually never get used to positive experience with family and friends. And by never get used to, I mean it always kind of shines.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have John on the line now in Dallas. Hey, John.
Well, good afternoon. I've got a couple of questions. One is, could you talk about the happiest cities in the United States? Where are happy cities? And the other part of the question would be, can you really pin a population number on a tipping point and say, at this population, they're not so happy. Below that population, it's a happy citizen street.
Thanks for your call.
Everybody wants to know who wins the who wins the happy contest. And I wish I could give you a definitive answer. But here's the thing. There are happier elements to every city. So my interest is in design. So some cities do transit really well. They create a terrific, fast, functional experience where transit riders feel great and everybody gets to work faster. Some cities, like New York City now, for example, is innovating in public space. They're turning unused or underused road space into these wonderful pocket parks where people come together. Times Square, for example, has been completely transformed from a big traffic jam into America's great central square. every city has something going for it. What has really impressed me most is that American cities are starting to retrofit their suburbs. So in Atlanta, for example, neighbors got together and they realized that all they had was a bunch of parking lots to call their downtown. And they decided to create a new vision of their downtown. And I think, this is Mableton, actually, and I think, you know, maybe one day Mableton will be America's happiest city if these neighbors can realize their dream of creating a walkable, mixed-use place where people can either drive to and hang out, or some people can live above shops and services if they want.
And people aren't always crazy about the hassles of a parking garage, but in some ways it can create more, I guess, more usable space than a giant football field-sized parking lot.
Well, yeah, you know, Americans, I don't know how many, I think there's 7 to 9 parking spots for every car in the USA. Hmm. So you've made this tremendous investment in parking. And I actually think if Americans, individuals and governments looked at their pocketbooks a little more carefully, they might be a bit smarter with their investments. You know, this has happened in an experimental town outside of Freiburg in Germany called Vauban, where they decided, look, we want to internalize the cost of parking. In other words, most people don't realize that when you buy a house, you're also buying the parking on the street or nearby parking. In Vauban, they said, look, we want to have a walkable space where children can be free at 5 years old to walk to school if they want. So the rule was they build a nice parking garage at the edge of the village. If you own a car and move to Vauban, you have to spend the $20,000, $30,000 it costs to buy one of those parking spots. If you don't own a car, if you rely on transit, well, then you get a share of the little park at the center of the village. What it means is that this really is a safe, friendly place where everybody starts their day with a little walk.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Michael in East Dallas. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Great, thank you.
I wanted to make a comment, and I'm 60 years old, and I've worried about rent or mortgage all my life. That's our biggest worry. We, the people out here, pay too much mortgage. We pay too much rent. And our politicians are always talking about what can we do to prop up housing values. They had a crime wave in the 60s and 70s and 80s and tried to scare people to move to the suburbs. Now we can stop crime with our cell phones, and I don't know what the reason is for moving to the suburbs now, but the high cost of housing is just really tearing people to pieces. That makes people unhappy all the time. And I think the happiest state in the country is Colorado.
Hmm. Charles, any
thoughts? And I know why.
Well, you know, I can't argue with that. The high cost of housing is a strain on people in cities all over the world. My city in particular is feeling it acutely. This is Vancouver, Canada, partly because we have so much investment from overseas. It's seen as a good investment because everybody wants to live here now. I want to say two things. First of all, again, remember that your everyday expenses include housing and transportation. So if we can build more housing and more low-cost housing for people, which is close to work, close to transit, walkable, then people can save hundreds of dollars a month on transportation costs and live a healthier life as well. You know, Dallas, I think, has a tremendous opportunity. So looking at supply and demand, one way to bring the cost of housing down is build more of it. Now, I was just zooming in on Dallas on Google Earth, and I see you have this this tangle of freeways around your downtown. And then I realized that there's a movement to tear down I-345. Mm-hmm. I think they're called a New Dallas. I was really impressed. You have all this land that is separating downtown Dallas from some close-by neighborhoods. What if you could use this land to build a series of interconnected neighborhoods? You could get billions of investment. You can create 25,000 new residents, walkable neighborhoods, little parks. This is happening in other cities all over the world. When you start valuing your land differently, stop wasting your money on freeways and start building communities for people to live in.
How close do people need to be to either day-to-day services or retail or public transit, at least, in order to feel comfortable not using a car on a daily basis?
Well, I think it's different for all of us, but here's what we know. If you can walk 5 minutes to a frequent transit, you'll probably do it. I see this in my own life. If you can't, you won't. And it's really also important to say that you need to establish a certain level of density for transit to be a worthwhile investment for governments. If there are so few people that your bus only comes once every couple of hours, it might as well not even be there. So I would think of the 5 minute walk. It's also important to say that we don't all need to move into apartment or condo towers. You can achieve those densities that support businesses and transit without going to the city of towers, because I know a lot of people don't want to live in towers. And I think that that medium density, it actually exists in the inner suburbs, the old streetcar suburbs that many cities built about 100 years ago.
And that density exists because individual freestanding houses are close together, or what makes them sort of the ideal density?
Well, here's where I'm a bit ignorant on the history of Dallas. So I don't know if you had those streetcar suburbs, but you certainly had inner ring suburbs that were serviced well by transit. In many cities, these neighborhoods were built by people who wanted to maximize profit by combining good transit, sometimes streetcars, with property development. So what that means is the lots need to be fairly small so you can get enough people living close to these transit stops. And what it meant also is that along the transit lines, you have great shops and services. All the stores that we think of in the traditional American main street that have disappeared in most places. It's important to say, though, and I know you have such neighborhoods in Dallas, they've emptied out over the past 60 years as family sizes have shrunk and as neighborhoods have been divided by freeways. So in my city, what we've done is build new gentle density. And what that means is everybody with a single family home in my hood has the right to have a basement suite to rent out and can turn their garage into a rental cottage.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is journalist Charles Montgomery. We're talking about his new book, Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Charles Montgomery about his book, Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Charles, I want to go back to this idea that you introduced just before the break called gentle density, which is such a nice term. And this is where homeowners in certain areas have been given the right to either rent out garage apartments or basement apartments. This seems like a really good way to introduce mixed income neighborhoods where maybe only middle and upper middle class people could afford to live before.
Well, I think so. And if you look at the example of my city, not my whole city, because Vancouver is becoming a very wealthy city, but my neighborhood, which is east of Vancouver, I look at my own street, and I'm looking out the window now on one side. So these are all fairly small lots. We all have our own home, so we have space. We can regulate our interactions with other people. There's nobody banging on the wall. But look at one side of me, and there's a house with just one person living in it. I think he's lived there all his life. Over in the other direction, there's a house owned by a woman in her 70s who's not making much money anymore, and she rents out the other two floors of her house to other tenants. Another block over, somebody has turned their garage into a rental cottage, and this is, again, supported by the city. So what it means is that all kinds of people can live in my neighborhood. And let me tell you, we're not afraid of poor people in my neighborhood, because without them, there wouldn't be enough people to support the businesses on the main street several blocks away.
Hmm.
There wouldn't be enough bums on the seats in transit to support frequent transit. I can get downtown Vancouver, and I don't even think about the transit schedule. I just walk down five blocks, and there's always a bus because there's so many people using it.
1-800. I just want to. you meant like bottoms in seats, not homeless people. And forgive me for just to clarify
yes,
to make sure that we're using the right terms here. Right.
Yes, no, bums like my own bum and your bum and other people's bums occupying, warming the seats.
Perfect. Perfect. We had a little cultural issue there, but we've cleared it up. So thank you for that. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jesse on the line in Dallas. Hey, Jesse.
Hi. Thanks for speaking.
Sure.
We enjoy this program. My call is about the idea that when you're growing a family that you need more space, and perhaps not even when growing a family, but the idea that everybody needs their own space, their own sink, their own bathroom, a man cave, a craft room. It seems to be, at least in Dallas and the Texas area, that it's just the bigger the better, and everybody has their own space, and there's just not an intimacy in the home. We recently sold a three-bedroom home that we purchased when we were expecting our first child in Dallas, and we actually just downsized to a one-bedroom condo, did not allow ourselves to put anything in storage, so it's been a transition, but we have much more time, much more money, and we're just close to each other. We share a room now with our two-year-old daughter, and a lot of people seem to be appalled by this idea, even suggesting that it might be illegal. And that we would be sharing a room with her. But I have to say, it's been really great, and it's been a lot easier, and we haven't regretted it.
What an interesting perspective. Thank you so much for your call, Jesse.
I salute you. I salute you. I'm in a similar situation, well, not quite similar situation myself. After we mistakenly poured so much money into this renovation of this house, my old friend Carrie and I, again, it's Vancouver, so it took two of us to buy a house, we realized we couldn't afford the place, and we couldn't afford all this new, sunny, executive-style space we had created for ourselves. And but the upshot was that we, after many years, invited our partners to live with us. And, you know, we're in our 40s, so it's about time, but we still couldn't afford the space. So then we started renting out an extra room. And what that has meant is, despite ourselves, our life has gotten so much easier. It's gotten cheaper. And everybody takes the turn cooking meals. But I think, like your caller has experienced, society tends to look at different arrangements of living as weird or strange. Well, it's time we all checked our own assumptions at the door, I think, if we want to experience true happiness. Because, you know, the biggest, the fastest growing household in the United States consists of single people. And does a single person really need a three-bedroom detached house in the suburbs? To me, that strikes me as a machine for loneliness.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jane in Dallas. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, given that we have so much infrastructure already built, especially around Dallas and its suburbs in our auto-centric society, what other changes can we do other than tearing down houses and redeveloping in order to be more dense?
I would think you have a couple of opportunities. Number one, didn't you just blow up the old football stadium?
Imploded it, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and I believe there are plans to redevelop that area into a mixed-use town center. So you have these tremendous opportunities where there is underperforming malls or empty space where you can create new suburban town centers. And I don't mean malls. I mean true town centers that are owned by the municipality where you can develop according to the wishes of local people, get together, hold forums, figure out the kind of town you want, and then rezone, change the law so you can build it. That's one opportunity. The other is, give more freedom to people to do what they want with the land they've got. So, again, people living in big suburban homes who can't afford them anymore, why not consider taking in some renters? Why not allow for more corner stores or things like that operating in your cul-de-sac neighborhoods?
What is the ideal balance of action taken by municipal governments or individuals or particular neighborhood associations? Is there sort of a right way to get everybody doing what they need to do for the good of the entire community?
Wow, what a question. Well, I think the starting point is for us to all have these conversations. And I do know that planning processes and public engagement processes in the states and in Canada are a little bit flawed in that you tend to only hear from people who are against stuff. And so one thing my neighborhood is looking at, or my city is looking at doing, because they wanted to put some towers in my neighborhood and people raised hell, is they think they're going to pull together a citizens' assembly now. And what that means is a bunch of people get appointed to this group. You spend 3 or 4 months really learning about the problems and together coming up with a solution to present to the rest of your city. I think the solutions need to come from deep engagement, not just voting every few years.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Anne in North Richland Hills. Hello, Anne.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I'd like to know what your guest thinks of sort of pseudo-urban neighborhoods like mine, hometown in North Richland Hills, which is which was designed by the same architects that designed Seaside in Florida. And it's a neighborhood where all of the homes have front porches. The streets are intentionally much narrower than the regular streets in the other parts of the city. The sidewalks are much wider. We have an elementary school. We have our rec center, our city rec center, our city public library, and several stores and restaurants all within walking distance.
Well, before we get Charles's answer, Anne, how do you think it works?
I love it. I absolutely love it. I'm a city person at heart, and I'm really interested in this conversation. I think, you know, we are sitting here in the middle of the suburbs, but I don't feel as much like I live in the suburbs.
Well, thanks for your call. What do you think, Charles?
Well, it's funny. In Happy City, I talk about this movement, and particularly Seaside, Florida, was a groundbreaking project where the architects and developers attempted to recreate the kind of places that Americans love to visit or live in. And the remarkable thing is they had to rewrite the laws. They had to create an entirely new code to create a place like Seaside. Now, your caller lives in such a neighborhood. I imagine this was either an entirely new development or it required a specific ordinance. Because in most places, it's illegal to build like that. It's illegal to mix uses, for example. Streets, most American streets have to be super wide so emergency vehicles can get down them, which is actually not always the best thing for emergency response, and I can talk about that after. So I think it's great what's happening, but most people need to realize that you're going to have to change your laws if you want more places like this in cities.
Well, explain what you alluded to about emergency response and not necessarily needing the streets to be wide enough to accommodate those vehicles.
Okay, well, remember I spoke to you earlier about cognitive quirks or these errors we all make in assessing risk and reward. One thing we tend to do is we tend to take action when a risk is salient. In other words, what's the scariest thing you can imagine in your neighborhood? It's usually a burning house. Mm-hmm. And so planners and road designers have responded by saying, well, we need roads that are wide enough for emergency vehicles, often wide enough for a fire truck to turn around in. Well, as it turns out, those roads do two things. Number one, they cause people to drive faster. So A, more people are getting hit by fast vehicles. B, parents are more scared to let their children run out on the street. So kids are put at risk of diseases of affluence. But C, most amazingly and tragically, in my opinion, you build so many wide streets like that, your community gets so sprawling that it actually takes the fire trucks longer to get to you because of the physics of and cost of creating new fire stations.
Were you surprised to learn, given how many different kinds of people there are, not just in the world, but even within any one neighborhood, how many generalizations you could make about the things that seem to make people happy or not happy.
Well, I mean, this brings us back to the start where, I mean, it's true that we're all unique and my happiness is different than yours. But there are certain things that contribute to psychological well-being for all of us. And you could probably list them as easily as me. We want to feel safe and secure. Income matters. It's better to be rich than it is to be poor. It's good to have a sense of meaning in our lives. It's good to feel like you can get through the course of every day without going through hell. In other words, it's good to feel in control. All these things are tied together, though, by the most important ingredient of human happiness, which is strong, positive social relationships. There's no substitute for it. Socially connected people are healthier, they're happier, they live longer, they're more productive. So all I'm arguing is, shouldn't we value that when we're building cities?
So talk about some of the things we can look for when shopping for a new home or a new neighborhood that we often tend to overlook when we're looking for these things.
Sure. I'd say if you want to maximize your happiness when choosing where and how to live, try to live close to work. Really important. So yes, think of your kids if you want them to live somewhere nice and green, but also remember that what's best for your kids is for you to spend time with them. So living close to work matters. Having that mix in your neighborhood is really important. If your kids can walk to a park, it really matters. I'd also suggest that you buy the cheapest house on an expensive street because relative status is important to all of us, even if we may not admit it. So, you know, the higher your social standing, the better you feel, and actually the healthier you are. But you can actually absorb the high status of your neighbors. So if you buy the cheapest house in an expensive neighborhood, you may absorb some of that status and feel better. Again, think of that five-minute walk. Can you and your kids walk to public transit in 5 minutes? If you can, you may be like people in Charlotte, North Carolina. When they put in the new light rail line there, people who lived within a five-minute walk of it lost an average of 5 pounds within a year because they decided to move differently.
And a little bit of green, I shouldn't say goes a long way, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that we set aside multiple acres at a time for little parks.
Yeah, absolutely. We did a study in New York City with the Guggenheim Museum where we measured the psychological effect of cityscapes on people as they walk through a neighborhood. And even a small bit of green, some shrubbery, a small garden, cheered people up. I would have to say, though, that there's no better green than the green that brings people together for fun, play, and activity. So much better than a big lawn is a small community garden that you can work on with your neighbors.
The new book by journalist Charles Montgomery is called Happy City, Transforming Our Lives Through Urban Design. Charles, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and I appreciate the calls as well.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.